Okay, we're gonna begin in just a minute. I just want to make sure, does everyone see the screen I shared with the group? If you didn't, if you could please let me know, I'll try to do that again. Also, am I audible? Do you hear me? Okay. So if there are any complications, please let me know. Also, Zoom always presents the challenge of interaction. It's a little bit less natural and a little bit more difficult, but I do enjoy participation, questions, and answers, so all of that is highly encouraged. Just also a brief note, I prefer rather than, if you have a question, rather than putting in the chat, there should be the option of raising your hand. There's a raising your hand button. And additionally, there's also, you could literally try to raise your physical hand or just say rabbi or something like that to get my attention. I just find the chat questions are sometimes a bit distracting. Okay, so before we begin, I want to thank the three organizations that are responsible for sort of publicizing this. Number one, I want to thank Zeifman's, as always, for partnering with our Beit Medrash in talking and discussing these important topics. Also, I'd like to thank Congregation of Shari Shemayim, who also helped in publicizing this, and as well to thank the Bayit. Thank you very much. Thank you all for joining us. It's not quite as exciting without the free lunch Zeifman's usually generously provides, but I guess this time we all have very pure motivations. So that's nice. Just to note, as I mentioned before, if you would like to get credit, if you would like to receive credit for attending the class today, if you could please put your name in the chat, in the group chat, and that way I'll be able to gather up everybody and submit that so that everyone gets credit for attending the class. Additionally, just want to remind you that if you want to, this is from Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. I'm Sammy Bergman. I am the Sgan Rosh Beit Midrash of Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. We have a three-part series on business ethics. This week I'm speaking. Next week, Rabbi Tarchiner will be speaking, followed by Rav Alex. There is a flyer. I can send that to you also. And if you'd like to participate generally in our business ethics shiurim, then please email me. We have an email list, and I am happy to include you on the email list. Okay. So to today's topic. Today we're going to talk about liability in pro bono work. If a tax professional, or really other professionals, let me just admit everybody, make a mistake in advising a client, and that mistake has financial repercussions, when do we say that the professional is liable, particularly if they offer to do it for free? So before we study some of the sources, and I'd love some participation here, who here, if I were to ask you, if I had some sort of non-for-profit organization which had a very positive public cause, but for one... I froze?
It must be him, because we're all still...
Oh, no. One second, please. Okay. Yeah, my connection is unstable. One second, let me. One second, please. Still frozen or no? Let me try one second.
Yeah,
I'm unfrozen.
Okay,
good. So I'm just gonna try to limit. I'm gonna try to close everything else and try to limit. Just give me 1 minute, please.
It looks like you have white bars instead of the red ones, which are
fine. Okay. I'm just trying to close everything on my computer so that doesn't happen again. Maybe limit that possibility. Also, we have a few people waiting. Okay, we're gonna try this one more time. Hopefully, it doesn't happen again. Let me share my screen again. Oh, wait 1 second, please. Sorry. Okay, sorry about that. One second, please. Okay, we're going to share the screen again. One second. Share screen. Okay. Okay, so we should be good now. You good? Okay. If I were to ask you, if I was the head of a very beneficial nonprofit organization advocating for an important communal cause, and I just had trouble affording a good accounting firm to either audit my financial statements or file my tax return, and I were to ask you whether or not you'd be willing to help me and volunteer your time to and donate your services, what reservations or thoughts would you have before volunteering? Would that be something you'd say for sure? Sounds like a great idea. What things would you think about before accepting that task?
How much time it would take?
Okay, that's a good one. How much time? That's a good one. And there's only so much time that we have. Any other? Sorry.
Exposure.
Exposure to liability, right. So that's the magical word here, liability. So the question, I think, and there's actually studies about this, many professionals are wary of donating their time and services because of the fact that they are afraid that doing so would expose them to liability. That being said, that's unfortunate because pro bono work is a very positive thing. If you look at source number one, on our sheet, this is just from CPA Ontario, and the question is, why volunteer? And it's very clear that they very much encourage professionals to volunteer their time. It's an excellent opportunity, it says, to network with other members and students. It's good professional experience. Actually, some have advocated that students, accounting students specifically, should donate their work pro bono to get good professional experience. Clearly, it's a form of giving back. And if you do have the time, it's a wonderful thing to do. On a religious level, it's a very interesting question in halacha, in Jewish law, whether or not donating your time constitutes charity, right, tzedakah, or kindness. I'd actually like to get your opinions on this. Do you think that donating one's time should fulfill the mitzvah, the biblical commandment of giving charity?
The old adage of time is money, so on that basis, it shouldn't really make that much difference.
Right, so time is money. I mean,
I presume the recipient is Jewish, which might be a consideration.
Okay, that's an interesting point, but there is an idea of even giving tzedakah to non-Jewish recipients. But even for argument's sake... Why?
Because it's more attached to money. If I charge whatever $100 an hour and I donate 3 hours of my time, that would equate to $300 worth of tzedakah.
Perfect. Are you still with me? Are you losing me again? Okay. Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. That really. So who said that? I'm sorry. It's harder with the screen share. Eddie, thank you, Eddie. So Eddie makes an excellent point, and this is really real. The Gemara talks about how shalvet kesef is kikesef. How if something has a monetary value attributable to it, it is the same as money. And if I generally bill a certain amount for my services and I donate them to you for free, so then that very well might constitute charity. If you take a look at the source number two, just an interesting question, not really our main topic, but just to note the benefits of giving your time pro bono. The Gemara in Sukkah here talks about the distinction between tzedakah, charity, and gemilah chasadim, acts of kindness. And the Gemara gives three distinctions, the first of which is that tzedakah, charity, involves one's money, whereas gemilah chasadim, kindness, involves either one's body, you know, their physical time, or their money. Tzedakah is only for the poor. charity is only for the poor, whereas kindness can even be to the wealthy, and charity is only for people who are alive, whereas kindness is even for people who are no longer alive. So at first glance, you might have suggested that this should be kindness, because after all, it says kindness has to be with, can be with either one's body or one's money, whereas donating money is necessary for charity. However, if you look at source number three, Rabbi Yehoshua Leib Diskin, who was a big halachic decisor in the 19th century in Poland, actually says no, that if you're giving them a present with monetary value, why does it make a difference whether it's a physical object or actual cash, or it's your time, or it's a service? That's also a way of giving charity. So there is a lot to talk about. A lot of beneficial reasons to engage in pro bono work if you have the time for it. However, it does indeed have its risks. So if I were to ask you, should someone who donates their time out of the goodness of their heart to help a client without any charge, should they be liable if they advise that client, even mistakenly, in a way that results in a financial loss? Do you think that they should be liable? Is it fair to cause someone to pay out of their own pocket for a mistake if they did it out of the goodness of their heart? Why would that be fair? Is it fair to charge someone for pro bono work, for making a mistake in advising their client? Right. So that's an excellent question. Volunteer versus being professional. It might make a difference. It actually might, depending upon how you present yourself. So we'll see. To Alan's point, if you look at source number four over here. Did someone say something? Okay. If you look at source number four, so the CPA Ontario makes it very clear, number one, that just because someone is volunteering their services without charge does not mean that they are not required to fulfill the accounting standards of the profession. As you look at source number four, the definition for employer is new and covers activities, even volunteer ones, where there is some reliance on membership. Employer is defined as an individual organization that enters into an arrangement, whether in relation to a contract or other de facto employment relationship, with a member for the provision of professional services by a member, or obtains professional services from a member other than a firm, whether the services are provided with or without remuneration. An employee, an employee, an employment, and any other related words have corresponding meanings. You are an employee regardless of whether or not you are paid for it, in terms of being required to fulfill the standards of the profession. Number two, the definition of professional services, which was previously in the CI for Rule 202, Integrity and Objectivity, has been modified to clarify the inclusion of volunteer services. A professional is now defined as a service or activity of a member or firm, whether undertaken for remuneration or not, where the public or a professional colleague is entitled to rely on registration with CPA Ontario as giving the member particular competence and requiring due care, integrity, and an objective state of mind. Meaning, if they're relying on you as a member of CPA Ontario, whether or not they are paying you for it, they are entitled to the expectation that you will live up to the standards of being a member of CPA Ontario. As the saying goes, no good deed goes unpunished. Whether or not you did it out of the goodness of your heart, once you say, I am a member of CPA Ontario and I am willing to help you, you are held to those standards. It's interesting that in Jewish law, whether or not an employee who works for free, who volunteers their time, is considered a full-fledged employee is not quite as clear-cut. If you look here at source number 4, rather number 5, this is Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Code of Jewish Law, and he's talking here about the penalty of an employee who backs out of an agreement. Actually, if you remember a few months back, the first session I gave in this context, so we talked about whether or not you can fire a client, which is a discussion of whether or not there are ramifications of backing out of a employment relationship. So the halacha generally is that if you agree to perform a service for a client and they pay you for it, and in the midst of that relationship, you decide you do not want to continue, and you back out of the relationship, and as a result of you backing out of the relationship, the client loses money, then you are responsible for that loss. You're responsible for that loss of money, and there are also unique methods that the employer has, the client has, of holding you to that. They could hire another worker on your account, the Gemara says. They can lie to you and say that they'll pay you more and then not do so. And that is the case if we're talking about a loss of money. However, if you look here in source number five, so the Shulchan Aruch actually, it's I think Moshe Isselis at this point, says as follows, HaPoel sha'asa b'chinam min bala bayit, a worker who works for free with an employer, yachol achazor afilu b'davar ha'avud, can back out of the arrangement, even in a case of loss. So it sounds like, in Jewish law, there actually is a distinction between an employee who works for free and an employee who does not work for free in terms of their definition as an employee. However, that being said, if you look at source number 6, Rav Shatai HaKohen, the Shah, otherwise known as the Shach, an important commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, says that although it's true that if you're working for free, you don't get penalized to the same degree, if the employer says to the employee, okay, I understand that you no longer want to continue for free, but I'm willing to pay you, at that point, then the employee can be liable. Meaning you don't have to continue working for free, but if you backing out will result in a loss and the employer says, look, I just need you to, let's say, file my tax returns. I have no replacement at this point. We're going to miss the deadline. We'll pay you for it. At that point, then you may indeed be liable. So as we see, just because you are doing the work for free, you are volunteering your time. It is a big mitzvah. It is kindness. It might be charity. It's wonderful. That does not mean that necessarily you are free from liability. So what we're going to do now is we're going to take a look at a really interesting paper regarding when accountants are liable in generally for giving tax advice which damages their clients, just generally, regardless of whether or not they are paid for their services. It's not 100% clear that all advice or services rendered which result in a loss for the client do indeed make the accounting firm liable. Just to note, one of the authors of this paper is David Wagner, who is a member of the local Jewish community. That came to my attention today, actually. Right, Torchiner, the Rosh Beit Midrash, notified me of that, so I do thank him. It's a very helpful paper. So we'll look at this from the perspective of secular law, and then we'll compare this from the perspective of Talmudic law. We'll see that many of the same concepts are discussed, although there are distinctions. And we'll hopefully be able to compare and contrast them. So take a look at North Source number 7. There are a number of considerations to think about whether, in terms of when determining whether or not a professional should be liable for mistakes they make in advising their client. The first status, step number one is establishing duty of care. Meaning, we have to establish the fact that the professional in question had to exercise the care dictated by the profession in this relationship. So, says the Mr. Wagner, the first step in considering whether tax advisors will be liable for providing negligent advice is determining the existence of and defining the duty of care owed to a client. The Supreme Court of Canada established the following two-part test for whether a duty of care exists in negligence, known as the ENDS-COMLOOPS test. Question 1. Is there a sufficiently close relationship between the parties so that in the reasonable contemplation of the alleged wrongdoer, a carelessness on its part might cause damage to that person? Meaning, number one, question one is, should the relationship you had with the client indicate that if you were not careful, it would cause your client a loss? That's question one. Question two, are there any considerations which ought to negate or limit the scope of the duty and the class of person to whom it is owed or the damages to which a breach of it might give rise? So, to sort of summarize here, what he makes clear is that number one, if you are a professional and you offer your services to a client, whether for pay or not, there is a reasonable assumption that they are relying on you. Meaning, because you're presenting yourself as a professional with expertise in a particular field and then giving them advice, it's reasonable to expect that they will follow your advice, and it's reasonable to expect that if you are not careful with your advice, then you should be liable for the consequences. So, number one reason to suggest that someone who works for free is still responsible is because they're relying on you. Whether or not they are paying you, they are still relying on you, and that brings it with it a certain amount of responsibility. So that test often is met. The question that we need to ask in these circumstances is whether or not, in terms of whether you should be liable, is can we reasonably assume that they are relying on your services? The second thing he says, once they are relying on your services and you need to be careful because of that reliance, the second question is, are there any external factors which mitigate liability? And this is actually an interesting question, which also, we'll see, has many parallels in Talmudic law. So if you look here, he mentions a few different circumstances whereby, even though you were a professional and they were relying on your services, there might be a reason from the court's perspective to not find the professional liable. So number one, A, the imposition of indeterminate liability. Meaning, even if there was a duty of care and they were relying on you, can we clearly associate their loss with your advice? There might be other factors at hand which also contributed to their loss. Just because you give advice does not necessarily mean that that advice caused the loss in question. So that's one thing to think about. And the causation factor is definitely a big factor we will see is echoed in halakha. Number two, whether liability should be imposed, where the tax advice given includes a disclaimer and non-reliance clauses. Meaning, what if you say in your contract, but don't rely on me, I'm just giving you my advice for free. Whether or not that should make a difference is a question. That's not something I wanted to talk about from a halachic perspective in this particular session, but it is certainly an interesting one. And three, or C here, whether finding liability in respect of opinion letters could have the effect of restricting the public's access to such opinions. Meaning, if we hold every single accountant liable whenever they make a mistake, what will the inevitable result of that be? Accountants will be much less willing to offer their services without a number of different considerations. There'll be a lot more paperwork and extensive opinions involved. And if we're too particular with accountants, then we're actually inhibiting the public interest because then they won't have accountants available to help them when they need help. And I just want to mention this as a brief aside. This actually does have an echo in the Talmud, although it doesn't seem to be applicable to our cases. So just to mention, the Talmud mentions the case of a worker who is carrying barrels, cargo, for their employer. And in the course of doing so, the employee in the Gemara drops the barrel and breaks it. Breaks the barrel. And there is an idea in the Gemara that although, based on the letter of the law, the worker should be liable under such circumstances, nevertheless, we don't want there to be a situation where no one volunteers to help their friend carrying cargo. Because that's bad for society. And if everybody knows that if you offer to help your friend with their things and then you drop them, you'll have to pay for it. No one's going to volunteer anymore. And we don't want that. Therefore, the rabbis say that although you should be liable, we allow you to swear that you weren't negligent in dealing with the cargo. And after you swear that you weren't negligent, you are no longer liable. However, so this idea of the effect that liability will have on society is talked about in Jewish law as well. However, later authorities suggest that we can't expand this to the case beyond the actual case of the Gemara. That is talking about a particular case of employees handling cargo. It's not clear that you can extrapolate. It might be specific to that case, particularly given that the employees involved might be people with less means or poor or indigent and reliant on this type of work, and therefore, that's why we don't find them liable. So, what I do want to talk about at greater length is the question of causation and the question of reliance on advice, financial advice, in Jewish law. When in Jewish law is a professional mistake going to cost the employee or a professional who offered their advice to actually pay? When do we say that? So, to our Gemara, the best paradigm for this in the Gemara is a Gemara in Bava Kamma, which deals with the case of a money changer. Right? Keep in mind for a second, and this is important to realize, in the time of the Gemara, it was a gold standard. And the coinage, the currency people used, was really dependent upon the gold and silver or copper of those coins being acceptable in the marketplace. And you had money changers who, number one, exchanged different currency and also were responsible for identifying whether the currency at hand was acceptable and or whether it wasn't. And so therefore we have the following in our Gemara in Bava Kamma. Itmar, Hamara dinar l'shulchan even in tzara. A person shows a dinar, a coin, to a money changer, and then the money changer says that it's a good coin. And what happens? They go out to use that coin, and it's not a good coin. It's a bad coin. It's I don't know, counterfeit, illegitimate, not acceptable. No one accepts that coin. And so therefore, the money changer has essentially cost the person who asked for their advice a loss of money. Should the money changer be liable? So the Gemara answer is as follows. Tani chada uman pater hejo chayav. Betanya idach ben uman ben hejot chayav. The answer is as follows, and you can follow along in the English under source number 8. It depends. One source says it depends whether or not the professional was an uman or a hejot. An uman means a craftsman, or in this particular circumstance, an expert. An expert in identifying the value of coins. If the money changer was an expert, says the first source, they are not liable for their mistake. However, if they were not an expert, then they are liable for that mistake. That's source one. Source two says, "Betanya idach ben uman ben hejot chayav." The second source says, whether or not you are an expert, or you are still liable. So we have a contradiction between sources in the Talmud. And that often happens in the Talmud. Now the Talmud needs to find an answer to resolve this contradiction. Amar Papa Kitanya Uman Patr could go Danku Visser to Lotrikum Ingmar Klav. Answers the Gemara. When do we say that a professional is not liable for their mistake? It's if they are as much an expert as Danku and Isser. Who were Danku and Isser? Well, everybody knows that in the times of the Talmud, Danku and Isser were the best money changers and the biggest experts in evaluating currency around, right? If you ever want some good trivia, you want to ask someone who was the name of an expert in the valuation of currency in the times of the Talmud, it was Danku and Isser. Okay, so the point is that if you are a great expert, mishum de lo tzrich lemigmar, right, and you no longer need You no longer need to any more training. You are one of the top professionals in your field. Then you are not liable. Otherwise, you are. Says the Gemara. Ella b'mayto. If it's true that we're talking about the top experts in the field, then what mistake could they have made? If they're such big experts, why did they give not inappropriate advice? Says the Gemara, no, the case is that there is a very new coin that came out from the press. It was just printed. Are people still with me? I feel like... Is it frozen out? Okay. So, it was a new coin, just came off the presses, and that's why they made a mistake. They never seen this coin before. That's the reason for their mistake. However, these are the top experts in the field. If you're a top expert, you are not liable. However, otherwise, then you are. That's this first Gemara. The next thing the Gemara says is a story to illustrate this fact. We'll do it outside for time's sake. The Gemara says Rabbi Chia, who was also a money changer, was approached by a woman who asked him whether or not the coin that she possessed was legitimate. He looks at the coin, says, yeah, it's a good coin. Turns out, the woman accepts the coin as payment, goes into the marketplace, tries to use the coin, and then is unsuccessful in doing so. They don't accept it. Turns out, it wasn't a good coin. She returns to Rabbi Chia. She says, hey, they said it wasn't acceptable. And Rabbi Chia actually takes the coin back, gives her a better coin, and writes in his ledger, this is not a good coin. And he puts it away. So that's the Gemara. The Gemara asks, wasn't Rabbi Chia a top expert? And actually the Gemara says, yes, Rabbi Chia was a top expert. He didn't need any more training. Oh, no.
You know you were frozen for a minute or two, so you might want to go over what you
said. Yeah. Okay, sure. Yeah, this is... So Rabbi Chia in the Gemara was an expert money changer, and yet he paid for his mistake. And the Gemara says he went beyond the letter of the law. It was lifnim mishurat hadin. So from these first two stories in the Gemara, which is important, the important thing to keep in mind is the Gemara is saying as follows. If you are an expert, and not just an expert, but the top of your field, you require no more training in this particular field, and then you give professional advice, which results in a loss for the client, you are not liable. If you are not at that top level of the profession, if you are below that, then you are liable for giving your advice if it damages your client. Okay, that's the upshot of the first part of the Gemara. Someone have a question? Why? Good, why?
Because you would think if you have the expertise and you're being paid, you have a level of care that's higher than someone who's casually giving it. It seems to be almost look as though you said it the opposite of what I would expect.
Okay, excellent point. Excellent point. Okay, so Paul and Miriam are mentioning the idea that it seems counterintuitive that a top expert would not be liable if the reliance should certainly be assumed, number one. And number two, you could really say you caused the loss as a top expert. The truth is that there are Rishonim, I didn't quote them here because they're not accepted because it seems like it's against the Talmud, but there actually are... sources which indicate that, yes, an expert has more liability because that reliance is there, because of that reliance. However, that isn't the authoritative opinion. So the question will be, we'll have to think about why an expert would be less liable. On a simple level, the answer, I think, is that we can assume that the expert didn't do something that was negligent. The result wasn't due to a duty of care, as we'll see. So this really might depend on the field. But apparently, what the Gemara was saying was the expert could have done nothing differently. They did their best. They didn't make a mistake in judgment. It was a fluke. It was something that was beyond their control. If they're really the top of their field, they wouldn't have made such a mistake. And therefore, it can't be that they were negligent. As opposed to, if you're beyond that top field... then if you're just a normal professional or practitioner, we could say more confidently that it's likely that the reason that you advise your client in such a way was because of a lack of care. or a lack, and you shouldn't have made that decision if you didn't know better. So I think your point's a good one, but it seems like the assumption of the Gemara is the top experts in the field don't make careless mistakes in the same way. That's the assumption the Gemara is making. And therefore, the mistake must be a fluke. It's something that was sort of an extenuating circumstance that cannot be controlled. Yes, Miriam?
So what happens if that expert now makes, let's say, two mistakes? Is he now downgraded to not the expert and now he becomes liable?
Okay, so billion-dollar question here, and I wish I had an easy answer for you, is who is an expert? That's a very important question to ask. Can you lose your status of expertise? This is a good question. My daughter Miriam is here, I just have to say, and her name is Miriam too, and she's very excited for your participation, Miriam. So thank you.
No, but I was confused.
Okay.
Is this regardless of whether they get paid or not?
That is another great question, and that's what we'll see. At first glance, what would you say? The Gemara does not distinguish. Right, it doesn't say. So why would you, so there's no reason to assume that it makes a difference. You will see that there is another Gemara dealing with a ritual slaughterer where it does distinguish between a paid worker and a non-paid worker. And the question is why that distinction does not come up in this Gemara, this passage in the Talmud, about a money changer. These are all the right questions. So, right now what we've seen so far, and I think it's worth thinking about, we'll think about it more, is an expert, but not just any expert, not just an uman, but the top of the field is not going to be liable. Someone below that will be liable. However, there is one more Gemara here in Bava Kamma on 100, page 100a, and that adds another element into this discussion. The Gemara says as follows: Rish Lakish Akli Dinra L'Rebbe Elazar Amar Ma'ayehu. So Rish Lakish showed a dinar, a coin, to Rebbe Elazar. He said it's a good coin. Then Amar Lechazid Da'ala Kasa Mechna. Rish Lakish says, be careful, I'm relying on you. He tells the money changer, I'm relying on your advice, Rebbe Elazar. So the Gemara says, Amar le kisam chesalai maila mimra. Why are you telling me that you're relying on me? What's the point of saying that? Well, who cares? Di mishtakik bisha be'inalech lufelecha? Are you saying that because you want to make sure that if it turns out this coin is a bad coin, it's illegitimate, I need to give you a new one? V'ha'atu da'amit Rebbe Meir hu da'don dinan degar mi? My lava may be your like of us. So this response requires a bit of explanation, but the response is, wait, aren't you the one who said that it's only Rabbi Meir who holds one liable for causative damages? What that means is as follows. Even in a circumstance in which a professional is negligent, we'll say, in providing advice to their client, from a halachic perspective, it's not 100% clear they should be liable for that advice. Because they don't directly damage the client. It's not as if they took a hammer and hit the client's car, or they stole from the client. What happened was they gave advice, and that advice caused the client to make a decision, and the client's decision resulted in a loss. That is called causation, indirect causation. And there's a question in halacha when and whether or not one is liable for causative damages, for indirect causation. The Gemara says here, Rabbi Meir is the one who holds one liable for indirect causation, and I thought you don't hold like that. So even if you're telling me that you're relying on me for your decision, nevertheless, it's causative, and maybe I shouldn't be liable. To which the Gemara says, Amar Leh Lo, Rabbi Meir Usvir Lan Kavate. No, I do agree with Rabbi Meir. I do hold people liable for even indirect causation. You are liable for damaging someone in an indirect way. So what we have from this Gemara so far, just to briefly sum up, because I know it was a lot, is three factors. Number one, we have the idea of experts. Are you an expert or at the top of your field or not? And that seems to be an important factor. Number two, this reliance factor. This idea of chazid alei kasamchis. When you tell the professional, I'm relying on your advice. That's a detail in this last story. One question to ask is that detail required? Is the culpability, the liability of the professional contingent upon the client saying, I'm relying on you or not? And three, this idea of indirect causation. When can we hold someone liable for indirectly damaging another person? And I want to stop here for a second because I said a lot. Are there any questions up to this point? Anything that needs clarification? Are we clear?
I just want to make sure I understand the case that we were dealing with the coin.
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure what the loss was. If he hadn't shown it to the money changer and just gone out to the market, then would it have been the same? So basically, the fact that he said, no, it's okay, how did that cause the actions to be any different?
Okay, that's an excellent question. We're going to get to it. Right, one question that needs to be determined is what was the result of the advice? What happened as a result of this money changer saying it's a good coin?
A quick question.
Yes.
Presumably, if the money changer said that it was a good coin, the person could have exchanged it for, let's say, a gold coin, for copper coins, or for silver coins. The fact is that the person decided not to, and still go and use that coin instead of changing it at the money changer. To basically absolve the money changer from any liability because he doesn't have the opportunity, as the money changer told him that it was a good coin, to exchange it either to exchange it or to exchange it to other denominations.
Okay, that another excellent point. You agree. You are essentially saying the opinion, John, of Reb Ephraim. And John is essentially saying that maybe we should only hold the professional liable for causation if it's a clearly definitive causation. If because I said it was good, you had to pay no matter what you did. So that's something we're going to get to. I'm actually going to take one more question just in the meanwhile. I'm just going to stop a share for a second and just record. Because I want to just get to see everybody who's actually on the chat, have a record of that. Any other questions before we move on? Are we okay? Okay. So I'll just share the screen again. So at this point, the question to determine are, number one, when do we say causation? And number two, who is an expert? So let's take a look at some of the sources that discuss these issues. Okay. So if you look at source number eight, this is Rabbeinu Asher from Germany, and well-known, one of the great rabbinic decisors in his time. And he defines here for us what the basis of charging someone for making incorrect advice is. Why is it that we can say that the money changer is liable? He says as follows, Umara dina l'shochani. When a person themselves caused damage to their friend's money, uvari hezeka, and the potential for damage is very clear. Hu hanikra dina digarmi. That is called the law of causation. And he gives examples. Store shtar, a person who burns a contract. You have a contract of debt. And then someone burns that contract. You aren't directly damaging anything, but you are indirectly doing something to their money, which prevents them from collecting it. Or mochel, hu ba'atmo mazik l'mamon chavero. He himself is doing damage to the friend's money. The kachmare dinor l'shulchani d'bemesha omer lo shutov hu maziko. By taking the coin and saying it's good, you are damaging your friend. You are doing something directly to their object. And he's arguing also there is a clear result of damage based on what you did. So the Rush is telling us twofold here. The reason that you are liable as a money changer is under the idea of dina de garmi, of causative damage. And the reason that it falls under cause of damage is provided that, number one, there is a clear outcome of damage based on what you did, and you do a direct action to your friend's property. You're taking their coin and saying the coin is good. And that actually causes damage to that person. So the general framework we're talking about is the law of cause of damages. As an aside, or another important perspective here, is that that of the Ramban. Now let me just give you a bit of background. The Ramban is of the opinion that if a person damages another person's property, or even and certainly another person, they are liable no matter what. That Adam Mu'ad Lo'olam, if a person causes damages, whether it's by accident or on purpose, it doesn't matter, they are always liable. The problem is that we have circumstances where it seems that people are not liable for damage. One of them is a case of a worker. And the Rabban says as follows, She'ein be'umanatoa be'malachto mishum mazik. A professional who errs is not considered a damager. Meaning for the Ramban, what we're dealing with here is not damages. Because a professional, if you're working, if it's in a work context, if you're working for the client, you're not damaging them. By definition. Why then is a, why is the professional liable in certain circumstances? It says Ramban as follows. Va'af agav in source 10. De'bimare dinar l'shochan yichayav hasam kevan etzarech l'migmar. Ve'chazi posheyahu. In that case, since you are undertrained, if you are saying you are a money changer, but you aren't fully qualified, and yet you give the advice anyway, you are negligent. Because it's very common to make a mistake. It's if you are a judge who... If you act as a judge on a case when you aren't qualified to be a judge, or another sort of example, if you dictate, there's a law in Judaism that the firstborn of someone's, if somebody owns an animal, the animal gives birth, the firstborn goes to the Kohen. It's a question sometimes as to whether or not we can freely identify the animal as the firstborn. There might have been miscarriages and other circumstances. If you aren't a mumche, if you're not an expert, and you say it is a bechor, and then they donate that animal, and then it turns out it wasn't, you're causing them a loss. So to me, the Ramban is sort of saying there's another way of looking at this. It's not just in terms of damages, per se. It could be in terms of negligence. Negligence as its own category. Specifically, the problem is that you weren't qualified to give this advice, and you did anyway. And that might be its own category. Another consideration, another avenue of evaluating these cases is that of guardianship. In Jewish law, there is an idea that when you ask someone to guard your object, that they have a liability if they accept that responsibility. Maybe an employer is not a damager, but by agreeing to provide their services for you, they are a guardian. And guardians also have an additional liability beyond a normal person. Okay, so that's the framework for discussing these issues. So the first question we're going to talk about now is, when do we assume that the consumer is actually relying on the professional at hand? The Rav Yitzchak Alfasi in source 11 says the consumer needs to verbally communicate that he or she is relying on the professional. Because as John mentioned before, just because you ask someone for advice does not necessarily mean that you are solely relying on that advice. You still have some, you still have some free will here. You have the freedom to not follow that advice. So says Rav Yitzchak Alfasi, we learn from this that a non-expert isn't liable to pay until the consumer tells him that he is relying on him. For if he doesn't tell him, he can respond, I didn't know that you were relying on me. If it is clear that the consumer is relying on him, he doesn't need to inform him. So Rav says that although you are sometimes liable if you're not an expert, You have to say, I am relying on you. We don't assume reliance. Now, I would wonder, I think we can all question, and I'm curious to hear what people think. Should we assume nowadays that when people hire CPAs or ask their advice, that they are relying on them? There might be a big difference between a volunteer, or if you just simply ask somebody a question, hey, you know, I had this question on my tax return. Do you think I can get away with classifying it this way or that way? Versus someone who says, you know, oh, would you be willing to do my tax return for me? There really might be a difference in terms of that reliance. Miriam, you had a question.
I think there's definitely a distinction between you walk into someone's professional office or their virtual office. I think the implication, without having to state it, is I'm relying on you. You ask someone a question at a cocktail party, that's a whole different story, and there shouldn't be that that connection or that assumption
right.
Without the person saying,
right.
Now I'm asking you this question at the cocktail party, and I'm relying on you.
Right,
but walking into an office without saying it, I think, implies I'm relying on you.
Right. Fair. I think that's fair. And maybe that's what Rabbeinu Asher ben Yechiel says in source number 12. Says the Rush, Va'tosfo kasfu dafu lo amar lecha zedala kasamen nechayev. Says the Rush, whether or not the employee says that, you're still liable. Whether or not that you say that, and probably the assumption is that there is reliance. That's why they're asking you. Alternatively, another way to think about this question, and not just be about reliance, it also might be the question of causation. Maybe we can't really say that I caused the problem unless he says clearly, or she says clearly, I'm relying on you. Maybe we can't tie the result of the loss to the advice unless there's that clear declaration. So this is a dispute in the Rishonim, in the authorities, as to whether or not we actually require the statement. And that obviously would have ramifications in a current setting. Just want to mention that I'm going to try to move a little bit quicker now because I know the time is getting late. I'll try to stay later and look at all the chat comments and questions afterward. So that's issue number one. Issue number two, and this I think also relates to John's point that he made before, and that is as follows. What type of reliance are we talking about? What is the practical result of saying that the coin was a legitimate or illegitimate coin? Here we have an argument between Rabbeinu Ephraim, quoted in the Or HaZeruah, the work of Rav Yitzchak ben Moshe, and Rabbeinu Yoel. The first opinion quoted is that the only case in which you're liable is if it is a done deal after your advice. Meaning, what happened was, in the case of the Gemara, somebody, let's say the client, lent money to another person. He or she goes back to the client and says, I'm paying you back with this coin. The client responds by saying, well, how do I know that's a good coin? And the person they lent money to says, well, ask them. Ask that money changer over there. They're an expert. And says Rabbeinu Ephraim, the case is where after you give that advice, they no longer have any choice but to accept that coin as payment. So it's a done deal. And this is from a reliance perspective. It's clear that they're relying on you. Okay, we'll do it. My daughter's going to join us for a second. And from a reliance perspective, they're clearly relying on you, number one. Number two, the causation is very direct. Because you said it's a good coin, that was it. The case is over. They accept it. And now they lost money. And we can get into questions. Now they have to chase the person down and go back to them. That really is your fault. However, other opinions suggest that no, even if you have a situation in which theoretically they could have, you know, not accepted your advice, even if they could have asked for another opinion, especially once they say, I'm relying on you, then you are responsible for the decision anyways. So this is another factor here. And this really, I think, might also, it really might depend on the circumstance. So if you have a situation in which a client is asking for your advice, either financial advice or tax advice, investing advice, but you are not compelling them to do anything, you're not telling them they have to do that, So then that question would be subject to this dispute as to whether or not we really have reliance and causation in that case. As opposed to, let's say, a case where they commission you to actually file their tax return or fulfill their audit. In that case, I think you really could argue that they really don't have a choice. You're the one filing the return. Once you file that return, it's a done deal, and they get penalized for it. So again, this factor of inevitability, or whether or not the client has a choice in following your advice or not, is another relevant factor in terms of causation in Jewish law. So we see this idea of reliance and whether or not there is definitive liability is discussed in both Jewish and Jewish law and non-Jewish law and secular law. There is commonality in that regard. However, now we get to the question of number one. Sorry, someone have a point? Okay. I'm just going to mute. Actually, no, it's okay. Now we get to the question of paid versus unpaid. And here it gets a bit more complicated. For time's sake, I'll tell you the Gemara outside. But the Gemara in source number 14 talks about a slaughterer. And the Gemara says that there is a difference between an expert slaughterer who gets an expert slaughterer and a non-expert slaughterer. And there is also a difference between an expert slaughterer who gets paid and an expert slaughterer who does not get paid. Right? So the Gemara says that if you are an expert slaughterer and you get paid, you are liable. If you are an expert slaughterer, an expert butcher, and you do not get paid, then you are not liable if you slaughter the animal inappropriately and therefore render it non-kosher, despite the fact that now you've rendered a loss to your client. If you are not paid and you are an expert, you are not liable. That is the conclusion from the Gemara in Source 14. You can look at it inside. We're just going to leave it at that for now. So now we have the following question, and it's an important question. And I'll ask you, if we're talking about tax accountants, audit accountants, financial services, is that more comparable to a butcher or a money changer? What would you say? Right? Is the accounting firm more like the case of the butcher or more like the case of the money changer? Appraising a coin. Okay, good. But you would think the money changer, aside from the fact, why?
Well, money, accounting.
Good.
It's not the same.
It's knowledge as opposed to a physical act.
Excellent. Knowledge as opposed to a physical act. So we will see that. So there are many reasons to assume that we are more akin to the case of the money changer. It's knowledge. There's also, the butcher is much more direct. If I'm a butcher and I take my knife and I slaughter your animal, and I render it non-kosher, I have directly damaged your animal. I might have done it accidentally, but it's a direct act against the animal which causes the loss. In the case of a financial advisor or an accountant, I don't directly damage anything. It's indirect. So the question then is, the million-dollar question, wait a minute, why doesn't the Gemara distinguish between a paid and not paid worker in the case of the money changer? So Tosfot and says in number 15, the reason is because as follows. It isn't applicable to answer by differentiating between a paid money changer and a money changer who works for free, as the Talmud answered in regard to slaughtering, because recognizing a coin requires great expertise, and one shouldn't attempt to evaluate if they aren't experts like Danku and Isser. We get to Danku and Isser again. So says Tosfot, the question is, how much expertise is necessary for the job? Since money changing or appraising the value of a currency requires a very high level of expertise, you shouldn't do it unless you're the top of the field, unless you're a real expert. And if you do, you're liable, even if you don't get paid. Whereas a slaughterer is manual labor, doesn't require the same amount of expertise. You're not negligent for trying. And therefore, if you are not paid, you will not be liable. I think to sort of put it in more clear terms, in Jewish law, there is a distinction between a paid watchman and an unpaid watchman. And a paid watchman has a higher liability. whereas a non-paid watchman only is liable if they are negligent. That's the only case of liability for an unpaid watchman. Tosfot is saying it's only negligence in the case of money changing. In the case of appraising, rather, someone's coinage, it is negligent if you are not an expert. In the case of being a slaughterer, as long as you are an uman, you're a professional. Even if you're not the top of the field, so then it's not negligent and you are exempt. However, if you look into source number 16, the Rambam essentially equates the cases and does distinguish between a paid and non-paid worker, even in terms of appraising the value of currency. However, the Rambam does say there's a higher criteria. I'll just read in English. So the first case is as follows. A person gave wheat to a miller to grind, did not soak it. Hence the flour came out as bran or coarse flour. A person gave flour to a baker, and he made bread that crumbles. Or a person brought an animal to a slaughterer, and he slaughtered it unacceptably, they're all liable to make restitution. Therefore, if an expert slaughterer slaughters an animal without charge, and he caused it to be unacceptable, he is not liable to make restitution. If he is not an expert, even if he works without charge, he is liable. Similarly, says the Rambam, rules apply when a person shows a coin to a money changer and he says that it is acceptable and it is discovered to be unacceptable. If he charged for his services, he's obligated to pay even though he's an expert and does not require further training. If he did not charge, he is not liable. So says the Rambam, we can compare the butcher to the money changer. We can compare these services. However, there's a higher standard for money changing. You need to be the top of the field, a true expert. Not just a professional, but an expert. However, if you are paid, then you will be liable even if you are an expert. The Rashba, in source number 17, Rav Shlomo Ibn Adera, has a different perspective and says that no, in the case of money changing, and this was mentioned before, we can distinguish between manual labor and expertise in a field which doesn't involve manual labor. Slaughtering is manual labor, says the Rashba. Therefore, if you are an expert, even if you are an expert slaughterer, you might still have a slip of the hand or something like that, and if you were careless, you still might make a mistake. However, in terms of money changing or the appraisal of currency, there's no manual labor involved. There's no slip of the hand possible. It's a question of the requisite knowledge and application of that knowledge. Therefore, says the Rashba, a top expert in the field of currency or evaluating currency isn't liable even if they are paid. And when it comes to currency, a non-expert is liable even if they are paid. In terms of financial services, the question, according to the Rashba, is not about paid versus not paid. It's only about expertise. Okay. Nevertheless, if you look in source number 18, when we talk about the practical halacha, in the court of Jewish law, the Shulchan Aruch sides with the Rambam. It says as follows, when it shows a dinar to a money changer and says it is legitimate and is shown to be illegitimate, if he appraises it for pay, he's obligated to pay, even if he's an expert, requires no further training. If he appraises it for free, he's exempt, provided that he's an expert, who requires no further training. If he isn't an expert, he's obligated to pay, even if it was for free, provided that the consumer says to the money changer, see that I'm relying on you. Or the circumstances dictate that he was relying on his appraisal and would not show the coin to others. So, says the Shulchan Aruch, it depends on your level of expertise. The top expert for free is not liable. A top expert for pay is liable. A non-expert is liable even for free, assuming that the consumer, the client, said, I'm relying on you, or six circumstances dictate that there is reliance. So we need the reliance, we need the causation. So we do see that indeed there is a difference between secular and Jewish law in terms of the effect of pro bono work, but That being said, pro bono work, whatever phone that is, I would appreciate it if you could mute for a second. Pro bono work does not preclude you from liability, although it may have an impact. So now the question is, who is an expert? And this is the million-dollar question. Because if I am an expert, then I am a pro bono, I am not liable in Jewish law. But who is an expert? Now, this is a big question. In secular law, this is a very important question as well. Although expertise does not necessarily mean in secular law you will not be liable, there is another factor, which is as follows. In many cases, in order to make a professional liable for their services, I'm just going to mute everybody for a second. I think we're okay. Okay, in many circumstances, in order to prove that a professional is liable, an expert witness will be necessary. You can look at source number 19. If the claim is that due care wasn't exhibited by the professional, in many cases, to prove that the due care wasn't given, you need to bring an expert witness to prove it. Because many times, determining what due care is not clear-cut. If it's a case of not filing a return on time or something like that, that's clear negligence. You won't need an expert witness. But if we're talking about some sort of difficult transaction that was classified in a certain way, some sort of financial tax advice that was given involving investments and the like, how do we really determine that due care wasn't given? If the professional in question provided due care, then they shouldn't be liable. An expert witness is necessary, and who is an expert? If you look at source number 19, but it's really not clear. And unfortunately, the profession hasn't qualified we don't have qualifications for a particular area of expertise. One type of tax expert might not be an expert in another field. We can distinguish between partnerships and other types of fields. So it's a bit unclear in secular law, which has ramifications. However, I know I'm going over time, so I just want to conclude. In Jewish law, there are a number of considerations. Number one, you need to prove you're an expert. Says Rabbi Yosef Karo, if you want to absolve yourself from liability, you do need to prove that you are an expert. However, and the Meiri says in Source 21, that just because you are an expert in one field does not mean you are expert in another field. That being said, if you look at source number 22, the Rechida suggests that if you have licensure, if the committee in that country requires licensure for you to practice, so then we can sort of assume that they're allowing you to practice means that you're an expert because they wouldn't allow you to practice otherwise. Now, whether or not that should apply in Ontario, where once you are a CPA, you are a CPA for everything, and you don't need a license in a particular field of tax work, is a question. So, sort of in conclusion, and I want to conclude because I know we're a bit over time. Whether or not you are liable for pro bono work, and whether or not you are liable for general advice, is not 100% clear cut. We have to consider whether or not due care was required. We have to consider whether or not due care was provided. We have to consider whether or not there was reliance and whether or not your advice directly caused the loss for the client and what the standards for direct causation are. Do we require an inevitable result after your advice is provided? Or even if it's just suggested that your advice will cause the client to act in a certain way, which results in the loss, is that sufficient? And we have to determine who an expert, what is the definition of an expert in law. So all of these are factors that are considered. Practically, it's my understanding that firms get liability insurance. Liability insurance covers both pro bono and paid work, from what I understand. I guess depend on the insurance. And therefore, hopefully we can be engage in this type of chesed and tzedakah. We try to do kindness when we can because it's the right thing to do. And although it's not necessarily true that you won't get punished for it, hopefully if we're careful, we show due care we'll be able to prevent ourselves from suffering, and hopefully the good deeds will indeed go unpunished. So I want to thank everyone for joining. I'll just take a look for a few minutes at the different messages. And I just want to remind everyone, though, please do sign in by adding your name to the chat if you do want credit. So thank you very much. Okay, so let me look at some of the questions here just for a minute.
Sorry, Rabbi.
Yes.
Rabbi, do you need our email addresses as well?
I don't think so. No.
I've given you mine, but I just thought I should.
Okay. Let me just quickly look at some of the questions. Volunteering.
Rabbi, a quick question. I think it was in source 18 at the bottom where it states that you have to state to somebody who is not being paid that you're relying on them. Is that not basically saying that if you pay, that you don't have to mention it? That's an assumption that if payment is made, that you're stating by the fact that you're paying, I'm relying on you. Otherwise, why would I pay you money?
Right. It does. I think that is a good inference, and I have seen that. Yes, it does seem that is a pretty fair assumption. If I'm paying you to work for me, I'm relying on you. I did see actually Shar Yashav Cohen, who was a big rabbi and halachic decisor in Israel, makes that point that from the Rambam it seems that reliance is only necessary if you're not being paid. So yeah, that is a good point. I don't know definitively if we necessarily, I can't say it definitively, but I think it is a good inference. Let me just read some of the other text questions. Is there a difference between Chai and Besenas? Is there a difference between exclusive reliance and partial reliance? I think there should be. Yeah, how could you, if you're asking a number of people, then I don't think any one of them can be said to be the ultimate cause of the damage. So I think that would be a difference. Yes. Okay, any other questions before we go? All right, everyone, thank you very much. Thank you for joining us, and have a wonderful day. Reminder that next week, I'm just going to stop the share over here. Reminder that next week, we will have another share by Rabbi Turchina at the same time, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, everybody. Okay.